You ever wrestle with those really tricky spots in law, where concepts like intent or carelessness, which seem straightforward, suddenly get, well, complicated in real cases?
Oh, absolutely.
We've got a deep dive today into two criminal cases that do exactly that. They really make you think about the fine lines, you know? Intent, negligence, and how crucial the whole legal process is.
That's right. We're going to look at People v. McCoy, a Michigan case that really challenges how we think about self-defense and accomplice liability.
Okay.
And then we'll shift to a pretty stark vehicular manslaughter case. It forces a hard look at what gross negligence actually means when someone's behind the wheel.
Right. So think of this as like your fast track to understanding some core legal ideas. We're not just recounting facts, we're digging into the why. Why did the courts rule this way? What are the takeaways for understanding criminal law?
Exactly. Let's start with People v. McCoy.
Okay, McCoy, what happened?
So this goes back to 1995, a drive-by shooting. Ejean Dupree McCoy was the driver. Derek Lakey was in the car, too. Shots were fired. Tragically, someone was killed, others injured.
And McCoy's defense.
He claimed self-defense. Said someone in the group they shot at had aimed a gun at him earlier. He even mentioned being shot at in that same area before.
Despite that claim, the jury convicted him. First-degree murder, attempted murder. Pretty serious.
Very serious. But the story didn't end there. It went to appeal. And the Michigan Court of Appeals actually reversed those convictions.
Reversed them.
Wow. Well, it highlights just how vital proper legal guidance for the jury is. The appeal zeroed in on the jury instructions, specifically around this idea of imperfect self-defense.
Imperfect self-defense. Okay, let's unpack that, because regular self-defense, you think, okay, justified response, what makes it imperfect?
Right. So perfect self-defense, what we usually think of, requires both an honest belief and a reasonable belief that you're facing imminent danger, serious harm, death in the house. And the force used has to be proportional.
Okay, honest and reasonable.
Exactly. Imperfect self-defense, though. It acknowledges the defendant might have honestly, truly believed they needed to act in self-defense, but objectively looking at the situation, that belief wasn't reasonable.
Ah, I see. So they genuinely thought they were in danger, but maybe someone else wouldn't have seen it that way?
Precisely. And the key difference is the outcome. Perfect self-defense can mean an acquittal, not guilty.
Right.
Imperfect self-defense. It doesn't excuse the killing, but it can reduce a murder charge to manslaughter. Why? Because it negates the malice aforethought that, pre-existing intent to kill, or that really reckless disregard for life.
So for McCoy, his argument was basically, okay, maybe my belief wasn't totally rational, but I honestly thought I was in danger. And because of that, it shouldn't automatically be first degree murder.
Exactly that. He argued the jury should have been given the option to consider manslaughter based on that genuine, even if unreasonable, fear.
And the appellate court agreed.
They did. They found the trial judge's instructions didn't explain this difference clearly enough, didn't properly lay out how an honest but unreasonable belief could lessen the charge. It really shows how carefully we have to look at the defendant's state of mind, intent versus fear, essentially.
Makes sense. Now, McCoy wasn't alone. Derek Lakey was the co-defendant. How did McCoy's personal belief, his state of mind, affect Lakey's situation as an alleged aider and abettor? Their mental states could be totally different, right?
That's a super important point, and the appellate court hit it hard. They stressed that with aider and abettor liability, you can't just assume everyone's in the same boat.
Okay.
Each person's guilt and the crime they're guilty of depends on their own mental state, their own actions. So even if McCoy acted out of imperfect self-defense to convict Lakey of, say, first-degree murder as an accomplice, the prosecution still has to prove Lakey intended to kill or knew McCoy intended to kill.
Their mental states have to be looked at separately.
Individually? Absolutely.
Okay, so here's what's puzzling me. The appellate court reversed both convictions, McCoy's and Lakey's. If the main issue was McCoy's self-defense claim and the instructions around it, why toss Lakey's conviction too?
Good question. The court's logic was that the flawed instructions about imperfect self-defense basically poisoned the well for the whole deliberation.
How so?
Well, if the jury had been properly instructed and had decided McCoy acted in imperfect self-defense, that changes the fundamental nature of the crime McCoy committed, right? It becomes manslaughter, not murder.
Right.
Since Lakey's liability was tied to assisting McCoy in that underlying crime, if the jury misunderstood McCoy's level of guilt, they couldn't possibly assess Lakey's role fairly either. They just didn't have the right legal tools to evaluate either defendant accurately.
It's like trying to solve a puzzle with missing pieces. The whole picture is off.
Exactly. You can't understand the accomplice's role if you don't understand what the main actor actually did, legally speaking.
So, boiling down the key rules from McCoy, it sounds like, number one, judges absolutely must give clear, accurate jury instructions, especially on complex defenses like self-defense and its variations.
Crucial.
And number two, accomplice liability isn't automatic. You have to look at each person involved, their individual intent, their actions, no blanket assumptions.
Couldn't have said it better.
Yeah.
And the big takeaway for law students, really grasp the power of those jury instructions. They're the bridge between the written law and how the jury applies it to the facts. Mm. Flawed instructions can totally derail justice.
It shows procedure isn't just red tape. It's fundamental to fairness.
Definitely.
Okay, let's shift gears. Let's talk about negligence specifically. Gross negligence in a vehicular manslaughter case. The facts here are, well, they're tough.
Yeah, they are.
Defendant driving way too fast, 55 miles per hour in a 35 zone, hits two sisters standing on the yellow line. One died, the other injured.
Tragic. And what really stands out is what happened after the impact.
Right. The defendant fled the scene, didn't stop, didn't help, and reportedly kept driving recklessly, almost causing more accidents.
And it's that whole picture, the speed, hitting the pedestrians, the flight, the continued recklessness that takes this beyond just, you know, a speeding ticket.
Mm.
It pushes it into the realm of gross negligence. So how do we define that legally?
Well, the key phrase seems to be a conscious disregard of a substantial and unjustifiable risk.
Mm.
It's not just being careless that's ordinary negligence. Gross negligence is more blameworthy.
Right, there's an awareness component.
Exactly. It implies you knew or should have known about a serious danger, but you acted anyway, showing this like indifference to the potential harm. Our source puts it somewhere between simple carelessness and actually intending the bad result. It's that reckless, almost I don't care what happens attitude.
And courts often use a kind of framework to see if conduct hits that level, right?
Yeah.
The source mentioned a three-part test.
Yeah, it's pretty useful, basically. One, did the defendant know about a situation that required ordinary care? Two, could they have avoided the harm using that ordinary care? And three, did they fail to use that care when it should have been obvious that the likely result was, well, disastrous?
Okay, let's apply that test to this case. How does it fit?
All right, part one, knowledge of the situation. Driving 50-55 in a 35 zone, potentially with traffic around, that strongly suggests awareness of a risky situation where ordinary care, like, you know, obeying the speed limit was needed.
Makes sense. Part two, ability to avoid harm.
Witnesses said the sisters were stationary on the yellow line. If the driver had been going the speed limit, paying attention, presumably they could have braked or swerved. There was likely an opportunity to avoid hitting them.
Okay. And part three, failure to use care when disaster was likely.
Well, combining the excessive speed with the failure to react to visible stationary pedestrians, the court probably reasoned that any reasonable person would know that's incredibly dangerous. The potential for tragedy was high, maybe even obvious.
And we can't forget the actions after the crash, fleeing the scene, driving recklessly afterwards.
Right. That really strengthens the wanton indifference argument, doesn't it? It suggests more than just a panic reaction. It shows a profound lack of concern for the consequences for the people involved.
It paints a picture of someone consciously disregarding the severity of what just happened and the ongoing danger they posed.
So, putting it all together, what did the court decide?
The court held that the combination of everything, the high speed, failing to avoid the victims, fleeing, and the continued reckless driving, was enough evidence for a jury to find gross negligence. It wasn't just one thing. It was a whole pattern showing that conscious disregard for risk.
And the key rule here seems to be that gross negligence while driving isn't just about breaking a traffic law. It requires proving that conscious disregard for a major risk, often shown by a pattern of dangerous actions and failing to take basic precautions.
Exactly. The takeaway is how the specific facts, the driver's actions, their apparent state of mind, elevate simple negligence to a criminal act. It's that extreme departure from careful behavior combined with the high risk of harm that crosses the line.
So let's connect these two cases. McCoy dissects intent, self-defense, accomplice issues, and really hammers home the importance of proper jury instructions for procedural fairness.
Right. Very focused on mental states and procedure.
And the negligence case shows how a defendant's actions demonstrating a reckless disregard for safety can build a case for gross negligence.
Focused more on the conduct demonstrating the mental state.
Right.
But what's the underlying link? What are both cases really wrestling with?
It seems like both are fundamentally about interpreting the defendant's mental state, right? In McCoy, it's about figuring out the belief behind the self-defense claim and the intent of the accomplice. In the negligence case, it's determining if the driver was just careless or if they were consciously aware of the danger and acted with indifference. It's all about what was going on in their head.
Precisely. Trying to gauge that internal state belief, awareness, intent, disregard based on the external evidence, that's a core challenge in criminal law.
So, wrapping up the key lessons from this deep dive. First, jury instructions matter a lot. Their precision, especially with defenses like imperfect self-defense, can completely change a trial's outcome.
Absolutely critical. Second takeaway.
Gross negligence requires showing way more than just ordinary carelessness. It's about proving that conscious indifference to serious risk, and it really depends heavily on the specific facts.
Very fact-specific, yes. And third.
Accomplice liability isn't automatic. You've got to assess each person's individual intent and actions. Can't just lump them together.
Well summarized. And for everyone listening, keep thinking about these ideas. How might imperfect self-defense apply in other contexts, like maybe domestic violence cases or bar fights?
Yeah, interesting.
And what evidence really convinces you of gross negligence? Is it just speed? Is it distraction? What combination of factors is most compelling in different scenarios, like maybe medical settings or on construction sites?
Those are great questions to ponder. And maybe one final thought. Consider the bigger picture of how the law draws these lines between different levels of blame, negligence, recklessness, intent. What does that tell us about what society values when it comes to responsibility and causing harm? Definitely something to mull over.